Welcome to How I Lawyer, a podcast where I talk to attorneys from throughout the profession about what they do, why they do it, and how they do it well. I'm your host, Jonah Perlin, a law professor in Washington, D.C. This episode is sponsored, edited, and engineered by my friends at LawPods. LawPods is a professional podcast production company focused solely on attorney podcasting. I absolutely love working with them, and if you're considering becoming a legal podcaster or just want to learn more, check them out at lawpods.com. And now, let's get started. Hello, and welcome back. In today's episode, I'm excited to talk to Rachel Bosch, who is the CEO and founder of Fringe Professional Development, one of the country's most well-known professional development providers for lawyers. She's also the founder of Candorly, a tool to make gathering upward feedback easy and efficient. Rachel previously worked in attorney recruiting and development at top law firms, including Paul Hastings, Skadden Arps, and Sutherland, Aspill, and Brennan. Rachel is the rare How I Lawyer guest who is herself not a lawyer, but rather someone who works with lawyers and the legal profession. She's a graduate of Shenandoah University, Go Hornets, where she trained in theatrical performance and vocalization. So excited to have her and to have gotten to know her recently, and can't wait for our conversation. So thanks for being here, Rachel.
Thank you for having me. Also, that is the most school spirit anyone has ever given to the Hornets. So you're ahead of the game on the SU front.
I love that. When I was first learning how to podcast, because I left the practice of law before I ever had to sell myself or market or do any of those things. But when I started this podcast, I read something that was like, every podcast needs a catchphrase or something that makes it unique. And I decided to shout out school and law school mascots. And
God bless.
Here we are hundreds of episodes later, and I'm still doing it.
It's really I love fun. It.
So yeah, so let's talk about Shenandoah University and maybe Rachel before she was a professional development whiz here in our profession. Talk to me a little bit about your path from theater to working in law firms and with lawyers, because I'm fascinated to hear that story.
Yeah, so I mean, right off the bat, the reason that's the most school spirit I think anyone's given to the Shenandoah Hornets in a long time is because while I went to the university, I actually went to a subschool within the university, which was the conservatory. So I was deep in conservatory world. Things like sporting events and school spirit were very secondary to, you know, what was the upcoming musical going to be, who was going to be in the opera that season, things like that. So went to conservatory, really thought that I was going to end up, as most people who go to conservatory do, on Broadway. I was going to be a Broadway star. I was going to take it by storm. And I love performing. I really, really do. And conservatory was an amazing experience. I still carry it with me and use it, the skills that I use, that I learned there every single day. But I was sort of a rare bird. I mean, people might say that about me for other reasons. I was a rare bird because I was not very fulfilled in the arts. I was a professional actress, stage actress for a while after graduating, and I found the lifestyle to be exceptionally challenging. I mean, everyone tells you that, and they say, if you can imagine yourself doing anything else, do it.
Sure.
Because this is a very hard life, and I could imagine myself doing a lot of other things. And I had moved to DC because I had some actor friends who knew that they could get jobs in DC because there were a couple of agencies, particularly shout out to LPI, Legal Placements, Inc., who love to place actors as receptionists in law firms. Actors make great receptionists. We can pretend we like anyone. So we're very happy to smile and answer the phones and do all that. So I went for an interview at, as you mentioned, the firm formerly known as Sutherland, Aspill & Brennan, now sort of merged into the London-based Eversheds, now Eversheds Sutherland. And I went for an interview there. And unfortunately, the HR folks thought that I was interviewing for a paralegal job. And I thought I was interviewing for a receptionist job. And so we all agreed, this is very nice, but this is not the right fit. And we went on our merry way.
Sure.
A couple of weeks later, somebody at Sutherland took an unexpected leave and they really needed help going into OCI and fall onboarding season. And so they said, hey, call that girl who's not a paralegal. And quite literally, if it weren't for that, I would not be doing what I do today. I started working at Sutherland and was still performing. So I'm based in Washington, D.C. So I was still doing light opera down at the Atlas Theater. Newt Gingrich famously came to see one of our Gilbert and Sullivan shows.
Wow.
Yeah, that was a very interesting moment, meeting Newt and Callista in a fairy costume. And so was still performing, but also was feeling like that piece of me that wasn't fulfilled in the arts was starting to get fulfilled by having all this structure and being able to be creative in a different way through training and through finding solutions for people. And so I really just decided to go all in. And that was around the time that I transitioned from Sutherland to Skadden. And then from there, just kept building and building to the point where when I was at Paul Hastings, I was lucky enough to have an amazing leader as a boss who really showed me what she thought I was capable of. I say all the time that Fringe is her fault because she opened that can of worms.
Right.
And I started developing training and I started ad hoc coaching the attorneys there. And I really loved it. And to their credit, they could see that I loved it. And they were very amicable when I decided that I wanted to go out on my own and give it a go. So that's the very short Reader's Digest version of how we got from there to here. But at the end of the day, all I do now is think about why people do things the way that they do, what motivates them, what is their intrinsic guiding force. And honestly, that's exactly what I did when I was at conservatory. It was just doing that for characters on a page so I could bring them to life. And now it's doing it with real human beings.
Sure.
And very real consequences sometimes.
Sure. I mean, I love that story just because I think it also is such a great reminder of how professions work, right? Like one of the things that I've heard after interviewing literally over 100, mostly lawyers over the last 3 years is so many people think they have this like set plan where it's like, I'm going to do A and then I'm going to do B. And then on top of it, you go to people's LinkedIn and everything looks like a set plan because you look from most recent to oldest. But in reality, and I've heard this for lawyers and sounds like this for you as well, right? The world plays mysterious tricks on us. We don't know what moments are going to change our life.
Mm-hmm.
And if you bring your whole self and all of your skills to anything that you do, you may find something that you didn't even know existed that matches those skills. And it sounds like, right, a job that I think some people, frankly, some lawyers would find very challenging, which is training other lawyers, working with other lawyers, hiring lawyers, talking to lawyers all day, is something that your prior skills and training really led itself into nicely. That's what I love about that.
Yeah. What is it? We make plans and God laughs.
Yeah, totally.
You know, you're totally right. Like I remember saying to my parents at one point after I'd been at Sutherland for a little while, I was like, this is a whole world. Like I just opened a door to a universe that I did not know existed. And I think it is something that a lot of people find challenging, which is why we still have work today.
Right.
They do find a lot of the work very sensitive, difficult, full of traps, and they're just not sure how to handle it. And so being able to apply those skills over, I mean, we talk about transferable skills and careers all the time, but I think that we're still fairly limited in how we think about them. I don't think people think conservatory education and theater into learning and development.
Right. I couldn't agree more, right? You have to sort of like take, I don't know, like one level up of abstraction when you say, what am I good at and what have I done and what are my experiences? And then when you're in the job interview, right, it comes down to, I've never done this before, but here's how I would handle it based on my prior experiences. And I just think that is there. I don't know, maybe it's because the fairy costume is still stuck in my head like that. There's a magic to that that I really enjoy.
Good God. I'll send you a picture later, but you have to promise me it does not go on social media.
Deal. And for everybody listening, maybe we'll add it to the show notes. Just joking. Just joking. So talk to me a little bit about, you know, you've been doing this attorney recruiting, attorney training in different capacities for a little while now. Talk to me about how that world has changed in the time that you've been doing it, both in terms of what you actually do on a day-to-day basis, but also a little bit more broadly, how the lawyer training space has changed.
Yeah. I mean, you're very kind to say for a little bit now. We're going on almost 20 years soon, which is amazing. I actually started my career as a 10-year-old. But the biggest thing that's happened is there has been a massive elevation and professionalism of this space within the legal industry. As per every other conversation you have probably had about the legal industry, we're 5 to 10 years behind everyone else. And
100%.
Learning and development, recruiting is no different. I mean, I think some of the folks listening to this may be shocked to hear that when I first joined Sutherland and we were doing OCI recruiting callbacks, we had a coat check in Washington, D.C. because it was cold when you came for your callback in the office. Now people hear that, they're like, what? The pace of recruiting is one thing that certainly changed. I don't live in that space as much anymore, but that's one of the, I mean, that's just an obvious thing. The pace with which it changed, the rapidness with which folks get recruited is massively different. On the learning and development side, I mean, when I first started, for the most part, if you had any learning and development in your law firm, those were also the people who did recruiting. Right? So it was like recruiting and development, and that was the department. Then you started to see really the department splitting so that they could exhibit mastery in their separate areas. So the recruiting folks were exceptional recruiters. They started doing more than OCI. They started doing lateral recruiting and started being strategic about that, looking at partner groups and moving those. That used to be something that only the partnership did. And then it started becoming an aspect of the professional staff. And on the development side, you started to see a maturation of that business as well, where we weren't just doing orientation and maybe a mid-level seminar once a year,
right?
But where people started building out entire academies. They started thinking about learning paths for their attorneys. I think when I look at the recent changes, that past 5 years or so, I'd say two things really stand out, and I may add a third just to because I can.
Sure.
I'm sure you'll let me. The first is really thinking about adding coaching as a tool. Coaching for the longest time in law firms was sort of the march towards the exit. Coaching was only there for outplacement. You were being asked to leave. We didn't want you to really hate us, but we would like you to go swiftly. So we get you a coach who helps you prepare for your job interviews and you get the hell out.
Right.
Coaching is really now being used as a deep developmental tool, and it's being used at all levels of the organization. Now you see law firms who have their own internal coaching staffs as well as partner with external coaches.
Yeah.
And so that's a huge shift. The other shift that we see is now a focus on leadership training. And that's in a way that we didn't before. It used to be like, oh, you're a senior associate or you're a partner. You're done learning. Mazel tov. Have a lovely life. And now we're realizing, oh, we're actually never done learning. And there's a whole new skill set that you need as a leader, as a partner. And we're seeing intentional leadership curriculums built around that group to really help lift them up and give them the skills that they need. If I added a third, it would be a selfish one. And it's because it's the thing that I never had. So I'm thrilled when I see it. And it is bringing the learning and development aspect of these teams to the business services organizational units. And we're seeing that so much more. Like, we've done full curriculums for business managers, and it lights me up because those folks, I mean, I know I'm speaking to an audience of lawyers, but let's be frank, those folks run the firms. If they all went on strike one day, if they unionized and just decided they were done, I can just imagine the mess that would be left in a lot of these firms.
Totally.
And so treating them as internal experts instead of support staff is huge. So that's my third, if I was going to add a third.
Yeah. I mean, there's so much in there to unpack. And it's funny because I sort of sit on the academic side, on the law school side, and I've seen, frankly, a similar change from when I was a student a few years ago to when I joined the faculty 5 years ago to what we're doing today. And just like you said, the sort of individualization of the training is also true for our career services department, right? I remember when I was a student at Georgetown, your career services training was like somebody standing in front of your section of 100 people and saying like, here's the date that you're allowed to send applications. Make sure to check for typos in your cover letter. Best of luck. And if you want to find me, like, here's my office and here's my office hours. Whereas now we have a staff that is dedicated to basically working with each individual student on their individual goals and their individual like plan, which also meant, right, is a product of what you talked about, OCI, for anybody who doesn't know what that is, who's listening, on campus interviewing, right? The way you get into particularly big law firms, that's changed too. So that doesn't surprise me, but it's such an important shift. And I think it's pretty cool that you've been able to be a part of it. You know, you've seen the recruiting side and the development side and now sort of are all in on the development side. I guess the follow-up question there is, do you ever miss the recruiting side? And what's your favorite part of the development side?
The honest answer is hell no.
Those people do amazing work, but it's not...
They do. Bless them. I will say this. The one piece, if I had to miss a piece, and it's why I do enjoy still working with summer associates, is I love that stage in a professional's life. And I get pulled away from it. People are like, why are you still doing summer associate workshops? Aren't there other people on your team who could... Yeah, but there's just such an electricity to that time in your life when you are just a sponge. And I did love student recruiting. Lateral recruiting always felt so, and I know there are lots of brilliant minds working on changing this, but it always felt so transactional to me. And it was like treating humans as widgets and fungible. And I absolutely just hated that piece.
Sure.
Not to mention, you know, student recruiting is such a predictable cycle. Lateral recruiting would come in, and any, like, if I was working on a professional development initiative, I'd be just driving down the road, and lateral recruiting was the train that just came and wiped me off the road. You know what I mean? Like, I didn't even see it coming, but everything stopped for them.
There it was.
And so there was always a tension, which is why I love to see firms separating those functions, letting them be collaborative and co-creative, but not necessarily asking one person or a team of people to do both. So what's my favorite part of PD?
Professional development, for those listening.
Yes, professional development. The very honest answer is creating converts.
Say more about that.
And yeah, I love either if it's coaching one-on-one or if it's going into a room full of attorneys, I love seeing people look at me through skeptics' eyes. What's this person here to tell me that I don't already know? I'm so good at my job. How could you possibly make me better? I don't need this. And then watching a slow, steady conversion. And coaches will tell you that they can see these things happening real time. And it's true. You can actually see people having insights when you know what to look for.
Yes.
And watching those moments is just my absolute favorite. Sitting in front of a room full of senior associates, and this is a real one that happens all the time, and saying, you do not have to manage people the way you've been managed. You are at a point in your career where you get to be intentional. So let's spend some time this afternoon thinking about who you, each and every one of you, want to be as a leader. And it's going to be different for all of you. But you don't have to absorb the sins of the past and pass them on. And watching the light bulbs go off to be like, wait, for real? I don't have to yell at a junior associate or send back a nasty email. I can do it how I want. It seems so easy to talk about it now. It seems so obvious. But when you're deep in the well of sort of indoctrination, of culture and feedback, you miss those key moments. And so when I see that, it's honestly, Jonah, it's to me, it's more exciting than performing to 3,000 people on stage.
What I love about that answer also, right, is that I think this may be a product, and I'd be curious if you disagree, but like a product of how lawyers are trained. Like one of my favorite phrases and like one of the things that I think is the defining characteristic of a lawyer storytelling podcast is this idea that we, even if we're not like we used to be a profession where you're trained as an apprentice, we still have kind of that apprenticeship model built into how we learn substantive law. And I think people assume that they're going to learn how to be entrepreneurs, business development, create engines and managers in the same way as they learn substantive law. But a lot of times those people were successful despite themselves, not because of. Do you agree with that?
Indeed. 100%. And just because somebody became successful in a law firm environment doesn't make them a good manager, doesn't make them a good leader, which is the point you were making. But also to go back to your point about the training, the way law school teaches you to think makes you a great lawyer and inherently makes you a crappy manager.
Say more about that. I need to hear more about that. Okay.
Yeah. Think about it this way. Sometimes I think it's helpful for folks to like take it out of work and bring it home.
Sure.
So if you spoke to your wife, always looking for the future problem, if you were always looking for the mistake, if you were thinking 10 steps ahead, not in positivity and not in excitement, but in how are you going to screw this up right now?
Mm-hmm.
How long would your relationship last?
Yeah, not long.
Right. That's what lawyers are really good at for their clients. Mm. Thinking 10 steps ahead, finding the traps, looking for the flaws. That makes you a bad manager.
Mm.
Because you just are beating people down. You need to learn. And like everything that we're good at has a sunny side and a shadow side. So we need to learn, and we work on teaching lawyers when to take the lawyer hat off and put the manager hat on.
Yeah. I mean, as you're saying it, I'm thinking about like, what's the first skill that we really teach 1Ls? It's how to issue spot, right?
Yeah.
And if your first inclination is I need to issue spot, that
this
may
human
not,
being,
this human being, yes. or this interaction, and identify predominantly the things that don't work about it, that's not necessarily putting you in the right mental mindset to be an effective manager.
Yeah. And the thing about being a great manager and a great leader is, I think Oprah had this quote once where she talked about giving, like she was talking about charitable giving,
mm-hmm.
and she was trying to encourage it, right? But she said, look, it's selfish. You feel good when you do it. Now you're doing a good thing, so I'm happy. But if you do it, you will feel really good, right?
Mm-hmm.
The same is true for managing people. When you do it well, your life gets better. Like if you teach people how to give your briefs the way that you like your briefs structured, and you take the time and you walk them through it and you motivate them through positivity, they will then do it the way you want it. Your life will now be easier.
Totally.
Right? It is a selfish act to train and manage and lead, but it is a positive one. Not all selfish acts are bad. This is a positive one. It actually helps both sides of the relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go at it, let me issue spot this human being. Let me issue spot this conversation. Let me look for the problems. You're just setting people up for failure. And there is also, and I am sure you're going to ask me some questions about this, there's a generational aspect to this mm-hmm. as well in terms of how people want to be engaged in work and what their expectations of work are. And we're seeing that now with lawyers who are joining the workforce. And I'm seeing it even like in my work in law schools.
Mm.
The vibes are different. And we're trying to prepare law firm folks for it. But I think a couple of them, especially, you know, this past year, 2 years have been the first year we've had Gen Z really in the legal space,
like totally.
Practicing.
Yeah.
And to be really frank, I think some law firm leaders had their rear handed to them. Like, I do not think they knew what to expect. And I don't know that they know how to handle that generation at all. And I think it's great for the industry because it's going to stretch them.
Okay, so let's dive into that, because I was going to talk about junior lawyers next. I'm just so fascinated by that sort of high level preview. So let's try to break it down a little bit.
Yeah.
And I will tell you, right, those people who are coming into the industry were my students 3 and 4 years ago in the middle of a Zoom pandemic. I mean, mm-hmm. I went to my first conference ever as a legal academic. The keynote speaker was Gen Z goes to law school. And the person doing the speech was someone who had written the book on Gen Z goes to college. And so
fun.
We know this is coming down the pike and we're still completely unprepared. And I think some law firm leaders, frankly, that I've heard talk are still worried about how are they going to deal with millennials? And it's like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Like we have a lot to talk about.
You're late.
Yeah, exactly. It's like that quote from the movie Rounders, like, if you don't know who the sucker at the table is, it's probably you. That feels like that this moment.
Yes.
So talk to me a little bit about this Gen Z going to law firms and what you're seeing, the sort of strengths or exciting mm-hmm. pieces of that, but also what are you seeing that they don't have once they enter the workforce?
Yeah. So I'm going to not answer your question right away, but I promise I'll get back there.
Are you sure you're not a lawyer? I love this.
Look, I've been around y'all for a real long time.
I can tell. I love it.
There is absorption. There is definitely absorption. I ask my husband to define terms on a regular basis. So I just want a quick plug in there to say, you're right about the millennial thing. Millennials are partners.
Right.
Those millennials like me who are now qualified as, I believe, geriatric
millennials.
Yeah. Yeah. Everyone can go screw off on that. That's rude. But that's the partnership now. Mm-hmm. Like, I will even say, we just a couple of weeks ago got on a call preparing for a program with a firm. And they were like, we really want the partners to be on. We got a couple of partners who are going to be involved. And these partners came on, I'm guessing 35, mm-hmm. maybe 35, right? So we all just need to reframe. And you're right. Some people are still like, what do we do with the millennials? I don't know why Tim Gunn is now a managing partner in a law firm, but
are they afraid of group projects or do they love them? Right. Like, I love that. Yes. Right. Exactly.
So that's just my little plug on, like, let's all remember everyone grows up. We tend to do this where we think of like, oh, millennials, they're 18.
Right.
No, they're grown-ups.
Exactly.
Now.
Exactly.
On the Gen Z front though. So a huge strength and obstacle in one for them. And it's probably one of my favorite things about Gen Z is whatever the conversation is, whatever the topic is, they don't accept the premise. And I just love it, right? Work is Monday through Friday, 9 to 5, right? Why? Work happens in an office. Why? You have to answer your email on the weekend. Why? When the client says we do something, we do it no matter if it's feasible or not. Why? God bless them. Like, somebody needs to be asking these questions.
Yeah.
And so they really are pushing hard. The challenge around that, right? So same exact behavior, but the challenge that that presents is, I think that sometimes there is a rush to push back and to label in a negative way things that are really a part of that apprenticeship model. So it has recently been illuminated to me. I hope this is not new to you, but maybe it is. And maybe it's new to folks who are listening, that, you know, like when you first start working in any team, in any industry, right? Like, you're the junior person, you're doing the grunt work. Like, you're taking the notes in meetings.
100%.
You're the one running through all the documents in the doc review, making the binders, right? Like, binders still exist, only in law firms, but they still exist.
Exactly.
And so, like, all of that work that is, some might say, grunt work, some might say learning moments, that now has a new phrase that is applied to it from Gen Z, which just boggles my mind, which is, I feel like you're not prepared for this.
I'm not. I'm ready. I'm ready.
Corporate hazing.
Really?
Really.
Wow.
Really, this idea that, like, I have to do work that other people, more senior people, would never do, or that I have to do sort of the crap work, the shoveling, the poop work, like that kind of stuff. That's where you learn. So that's where I think they're questioning, they're pushing back, actually puts them at a disadvantage, because that is where you learn. And look, like, I run a fully remote company. We do not have two people in the same city. Everyone only interacts in their home office or when we get together a couple times a year. That being said, I will tell anyone, there is huge benefit to those moments when we do get together. Mm-hmm. And in an apprenticeship model, there are huge benefits to being in the office sometimes.
Sure.
I'm never going to be the person who thinks that you need to go to an office 5 days a week. I don't even have an office for my company.
Right.
But there are benefits there. So I think sometimes the pushback and the questioning the premise becomes absolute and becomes almost polarizing. Like, well, if you don't understand this, you're the problem. Instead of trying to understand each other, which is a lot of the work we've been doing recently in this space, is like helping everybody understand everyone else.
Yes.
Right. Like, the management of these firms needs to understand the perspective of these Gen Z folks coming in, and Gen Z needs to understand the management a little bit better. And as I have said to a couple of people, this might not land with everyone, but none of us are Kevin McCarthy. We're not going to get fired if we compromise a little bit and try to understand what the other person is thinking. Very inside the Beltway joke, but
I got it. Well, we're both inside the Beltway, so I got it.
Yeah.
I guess and I'm just going to workshop an answer to what your question, right, of how we communicate.
Yeah.
Is the answer being open as a manager or a millennial or the generations before the millennials to actually answer the question why, right? So instead of to just push back on, because I hear this a lot of like, why would they even question it? And frankly, if I'm being honest, when I was a first year associate, I probably would not have felt comfortable questioning a lot of what, I won't speak on behalf of my students, but they question things that I didn't question when I was a student. I'm right. sure the same is true in the law firm setting. But if they ask why and you can give them an answer, then they kind of have a duty to listen. They don't have a duty to agree. I mean, they might
right.
in a corporate setting, but at the very least, you're meeting them where they're at because they want to know why. Is that right?
Yeah. So I don't think they do have a duty to agree at all. But then this is where consequences come in, right? Like if you don't agree, great. There are other places you can go work.
Sure.
And I think that's the piece that we're not necessarily understanding. So I think two things about the answering on the leader side, whether you're millennial, Gen Z, no matter what generation you are. When that junior person comes to you and is, why do I have to do this doc review? And like this seems like horrible work. It's mind numbing. I don't want to do it. Why do I have to do this? It is the responsibility of the person to say, this is actually how you learn. Mm-hmm. Like, let me talk to you about some of the things I learned by doing mind-numbing talk review, right? And then I also think that, you know, that's very much on the substantive side. That's on the learning side. That's very strict. How are we building legal skills through apprenticeship?
Right.
On the cultural side, I think not only is the obligation on the leader or the manager or whomever it is to answer the why question, but it is their obligation to turn it back on themselves first. Why do I need you in the office 3 days a week? Is that actually critical? Why do I say that I need you to be, you know, and this is hot button issue, but like, why do I need you to be tethered to your email all weekend? Are there times when I could say, hey, this weekend, I don't see anything on the horizon. Put the phone away. Don't worry about it. Don't check in. Take that time to decompress. It's our obligation to actually question our own cultures and say, like, why are we doing this? Is this necessary? Because honestly, like even the corporate hazing thing, which I do think is a bit of an extreme example, but I see how you got there. I see it, right? Like this is a generation that grew up with really severe outcomes from hazing incidents, very public, very much in the press. Like they were seeing this when they were in junior high and high school on college campuses. And the backlash was harsh. So of course they get to a corporate environment and they think, well, no, this is a thing we don't allow, right? Like think about what's happened in their high school and college campuses, the focus on bullying and like reducing bullying.
Yeah.
So then when they go into a massive law firm and some partner is seen screaming in the hallways and they go to like maybe a practice group leader or a managing partner and say, why is this happening? This is not acceptable. And that managing partner or practice group leader might think, I would never, as a first year or summer associate, have said anything. But of course they're saying something. And if that managing partner or practice group leader actually sits and reflects, they too should be questioning why that's acceptable. Because it's not.
I guess I'm with you 100%. I'm with you the whole way. But I'm I mean, one of the hard parts about being a podcaster and one of the fun parts, right, is like, I'm trying to ask the questions, like if you're listening to this while you're driving or you're on your lawnmower or doing whatever, like you have a question and chances are I'm not going to ask that question, but I'm going to try. So I'm going to take on the, usually
I'm going to ask why you're on a lawnmower.
Right. I'm never on a lawnmower, but that's neither here nor there. So normally I take the role of the like junior lawyer law student when I ask my questions. I'm going to put the like law firm partner hat, law firm manager hat on. And my sort of initial reaction is, yes, Rachel, I agree with you. Like, this means I need to look in the mirror. This means I need to be able to articulate good reasons why. Mm-hmm. But I may do that and say, you know what? I have good reasons and I'm the one running the place. I'm the one that's responsible for the success of this law firm, both financial and otherwise. And sometimes I feel like I'm not getting buy-in from my junior, right? They sort of, by asking why, have already said there is no reason and they're not really listening to my why. So what do you say to that person to sort of try to help them better respond in a way that might actually get some traction?
You're going to hear a pattern here. It's the same thing for that junior person who says, yes, I don't want to work in the office 3 days a week. I want to be fully remote. Okay, there's a consequence. You get to make that choice, own that choice, and go to a different organization. On the leadership side, if you're going to make decisions around culture that run counter to what are probably your stated values, but certainly the values that your junior associates want to see from you, there will be consequences. You are the leader. I've said this to folks in that managing partner seat before. I'm not here to tell you what to do. I'm just here to tell you what the consequences could be either way, right? So if you've got people who are screaming and throwing things, right? And you say, well, I don't really need to tell you why. They're very profitable. We want to keep them. They drive a lot of business. So their behavior is okay here. Great. That is a choice you can make. That is a business decision. If you decide this human being, regardless of their behavior, is so important and so critical to the financial success of the firm, that is a choice. Make that choice, but own that choice. And then be careful because you may have consequences. Every generation is a combination of the generations before it and then an amplification.
Sure.
Right? And so this generation takes sort of the connected nature of millennials, especially younger millennials, and just punches it up. Make that choice and then be fully prepared that that's going to be online, that people are going to talk about it.
100%.
That litigation god is picking that up and running it all over the place. I mean, we saw what happened to my former firm this year and their slides that got circulated.
Yep.
Make your choices, but know that all choices have consequences. And I think making those choices more intentionally, being aware of the consequence is just functionally a better way to be making decisions in any organization instead of just like, well, I'm going to say that this person's profitable. It doesn't matter. We're keeping them. And the way it used to be was everyone would just be like, all right, well, that's the sitch and we're just going to keep on keeping up.
Right.
Are you comfortable if that's out there in the world?
Yeah.
Are you comfortable if people know that? And if you are, make your money, man.
Yeah.
Like, but if you're not, make a different choice and be prepared to speak about that in a different way. I mean, I do just think that one of the great outcomes of this new crop of attorneys, and not just Gen Z, but even the younger millennials, is they are not asking for, but they are demanding accountability from their law firms in a way that I have never. I was just talking to a leader earlier today. They've just finished their engagement survey, and the overwhelming response was, we want upward feedback and we want it to be accountable, right? And like, that is a real thing. Like I said earlier, it used to be you made partner and it was like, well, you're done learning now. You're fine.
Right.
Nobody gives you feedback. You have a partner review process where a couple people say like, well done. Thanks for being a partner.
Right. Exactly.
That's it. It's very different now.
I think that's right. And just to put a bow on it, like, I think that idea of looking in the mirror, and this is for both sides, right? For literally for both sides, right? Looking in the mirror, asking why, and then also sort of accepting consequence, right? If you're somebody, you know, I talk to law students all the time about like, well, what kind of firm do I want to join? And my go-to advice used to be, well, tell me what city you want to live in. Tell me what you want your days to kind of look like, and whatever, frankly, old white man's dude's name is on the building doesn't change that much. You're going to get paid the same amount. Like, law firm culture is the thing, but it's hard. I don't think that's the right answer at all anymore, right?
No.
And it's because of this like more nuance, people are answering these questions or asking these questions and answering them. And there are consequences. I mean, something that I've been fascinated to see is my students who were on Zoom with me, right? Who then had to apply to be summer associates. Some of them said, I will only go to a firm that has a remote first culture.
Mm-hmm.
That didn't surprise me because I had them on Zoom. What did surprise me is I had several students who say, I will only go to a firm that has an in-person first culture, right?
Yeah.
And that was shocking to me. I'm thinking, oh, these students love being online. And these people are like, I've been online for 3 years. I want a place where the partners and me and everybody else is going to be in the office in a suit 5 days a week. Mm-hmm. And so like, make your choice and make your bed and just recognize that it's a lot more intentional than maybe it was before. Is that right?
Oh, 100%. I'm not surprised to hear that at all. And there were, as return to office became more and more mm-hmm. substantive, we saw in so many of our clients that actually new associates were coming in at a higher rate than partners. Mm.
That doesn't surprise me. And it was probably, if you drill down a little bit more, my guess is the more senior partners were coming in and the more junior associates were coming in and the middle was the group that was missing. I don't know, but that's a guess I have based on talking to others.
It depended on culture, I think.
Yeah, sure.
I think that's the, to your earlier point though, culture in firms is way more nuanced than people think it is.
Absolutely.
And there are a lot of easy ways for students to figure out what is truly important to a law firm and have it be aligned with them. I had a law student once ask me, I was doing a program on presence and sort of preparing them for the interview process. And some student said, what are the values I should have so that the firms want to hire me? Hmm. And it broke my heart.
Right. You can't see my face. It's going horizontal, not vertical.
Sideways.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I said, no, you do you. There is a firm for everyone out there. And there is, I know you talk about this a lot, like there is a legal profession out there. Maybe you don't end up at a firm. Maybe you end up at legal aid. Maybe you end up in a government job. Like there are so many different things that you can do. This trap of, I have to go to a big firm and I just want the big firm with the biggest paycheck is just that. It's a trap. Mm-hmm. And you will just be miserable. And then looking for a new job 3 years in. And by the way, 3 years is not enough to pay off your loans. So like you may have paid off a portion of your loan, but you've been miserable for 3 years.
Right.
So instead, find the place that matches you. That's an easy thing to figure out if you've done the time and done the work to figure out what's important to you.
Okay. So step one, right, to make this more concrete, step one is figuring out what's important to you. And especially for people who are, you know, we have a lot of people who are K through JD, straight into law school, straight out of law school. They haven't done that thinking and they may not even know what questions to ask themselves. But let's assume they get there. How do you get a feel for firm culture as a 1L or 2L interviewing?
Well, first of all, I will say this. We've got a values assessment worksheet. Anyone who, I can give it to you to put in the show notes. Anyone who wants it.
I will do it.
Like, put it in there. Because most people, it's shocking how many people I know have not done a values assessment, do not know what is truly important to them. So think about what's important to you and then reverse engineer your questions. A question I do not want any law student ever asking is, tell me about the culture of your firm. Because guess what answer you're going to get? It's amazing. Oh my God. What do you love about working at the firm? Oh, you know, honestly, it's the people.
Right.
I swear to God, every single person is going to say, it's the people, every firm you go to. Ask the questions that are more target. Like you are lawyers in training. You know how to ask targeted questions to get particular bits of information out. Think of this as if you are going into a deposition, not in a confrontational way, but in a pulling nuggets out, right? Let's say that equality and fairness are top values for you. Great way to figure that out. Ask, does the business services staff at the law firm have the same benefits package as the lawyers? Hmm. That's a great question to ask. And I'm going to tell you right now, it's going to piss off some recruiters. And guess what? That's great. Like, I think a lot of times, and I love my colleagues in career services, but sometimes they want to teach people to interview in a way that feels safe regardless of the firm. And I actually think you want to ask questions that hit a nerve because that tells you, oh, this is not a place for me, right? Like, I don't know if many law students know this. I know that there are lots of lawyers who don't know this, but a lot of law firms still have separate parental leave policies for staff versus attorneys.
Yeah.
If you care about fairness and equality, you probably don't want to work in a firm like that. So ask that kind of question. If you care a lot about feedback and development, ask specifics about what trainings happen and don't take sort of like the the canned answer. Ask really targeted questions. What's different in training when I become a third year versus being a new associate? How do you develop leaders as they move up through the chain, not just become partner, but then become a practice group leader? Ask questions like that, really targeted. Y'all know how to do this. This is, I'm not telling you anything you don't know and haven't been trained in, but applying it to this particular area seems to be, because we're all just trying to play nice. Interviewing is not a time to play nice. It's a time to figure out what's really important to an organization. One of the best examples of this was an accidental example at Georgetown when I was still doing recruiting. And a student came up to me in the suite and said, oh, you know, I'm so excited. I'm going to be interviewing with the firm. I said, that's wonderful. What area of interest do you have? Oh, I'm really interested in employment law. And I said, oh, that's fabulous. Like, what do you love about it? And this student looked me dead in the eyes and said, I just love the idea of fighting for the little guy and standing up for the man, standing up to the man. And you heard the three firms I worked at. So
right.
We know who the clients are there, right?
The employer side.
Right. And so I tried to guide that student. I said, go back and read the bio, because all these lawyer bios have like top cases on there, big wins. Go back and read that bio one more time. Actually, like, I don't know what ended up when that student ended up having that conversation. I hope that they said that exact thing to that partner. Because if they did, it would have struck a nerve. And it would have said immediately to that student, this is not a space for me. Not because, by the way, the firm is bad, and not because the student is bad, but because this isn't the place for that student. And that's a really important thing to figure out.
Yeah, it's funny. As you're saying it, like, I think you can probably sense, like, or you can see me, the others can't.
Yeah.
But like, like, some of this advice, like, scares me a little, right? Because I want my students to get jobs. And so maybe, and I'm not a career services professional, but like, I get that they have a really big challenge, which is like, this massive game of musical chairs. And the reason you play it safe, right? And I think you were, this is, was unspoken to what you said, is if everybody needs a seat, we don't know who's going to get what seat, play it safe and there are more seats for everybody. What excited me about your answer is when you talked about like feedback, which obviously is something I care deeply about. Otherwise, I wouldn't literally give feedback for a living. The idea of asking a question like, what feedback am I going to get as a third year and as a junior partner? If somebody asked me that question, not only would I be excited about hiring that person, right? Because they're thinking like I'm thinking, there's a values match. But there's no downside risk to that person, because if the person says, well, actually, we're not big on feedback, then that's not the right place for that person. So both sides of the equation get something.
Yeah. Well, and it's not dissimilar, even though it may seem different, from the conversation on why managers and leaders in law firms make some of the decisions that they make, right? Like, inherently, much like many other systems in this country and in the world, both of these systems have a lot of inherent structural flaws, right? We all know that it is important to get students placed for various ranking metrics
100%.
For the school so that then they can recruit again. I know you want your students placed, but I also know that you want your students to be happy and motivated and successful in a way that they describe success. The same challenge that encourages a law firm to keep a partner who is bringing in a ton of money, but is eating away at culture and morale, because that's going to raise profits per partner. They're going to be able to be on that ranking list. Those are both behaviors that are symptomatic of broken systems.
Yep, 100%.
We're engaging in behaviors that are rewarded, but that are not actually serving us in the long term. And that's a bigger challenge than we could solve in a podcast.
No, 100%.
Worth pointing out.
I couldn't agree more. I think that is absolutely the challenge. There are a bunch of other challenges that are related to that, right? The biggest one, and we'll go back to what you said, in my view, is you need to make sure that you know what you want. Because if you go in thinking you want one thing and asking questions for that thing, and you get the right answers, and then you go and it doesn't work, at that point, it was a missed opportunity because you were shooting for the wrong goal. And so that's why it's so important.
I'm going to yes and you there because Love I it. Do want to give folks permission to get into something and then be like, JK.
Oh, I'm with you there. Don't get me wrong. Yeah. Right. That's a yes and for me also. I couldn't agree more on that too. I've said this a ton of times on the podcast, talking to people, like the best thing you can do if you do something and it is figure out you love it. The second best thing is to figure out you hate it, get out and do something else.
Yes. One of my absolute favorite lawyers that I've ever gotten the chance to work with started out as a litigator and hated it, became an exceptional transactional attorney, now is general counsel of a huge corporation. Like has just like, if they had stuck in that litigation work when they were miserable,
totally,
they might not even be practicing anymore. Mm-hmm. So you got to be willing to be like, wow, I really went hard for this and this is not fun, right? Like I went to conservatory and then was like, this is not fulfilling me. I'm going to go now. Bye. I'm going to go hang out with a bunch of lawyers for 20 years.
But that's brave. And like, I really mean that. And if you're hearing this, like this is going to probably be published sometime in like early January when we're already thinking about like the new me and the new year. Like if you're hearing this and you're like, wow, this isn't right for me. Like it's brave to actually say I need to make a change, but it sounds like making a change is sometimes the right answer, sometimes the only answer.
Oh, for sure. It breaks my heart when I go in to coach a partner and I ask them basic question. Mm-hmm. How'd you get here? Give me the history. Very similar to what you did at the beginning of this conversation. And I get the answer, yeah, I don't know. Like it kind of happened to me. And I'll tell you, it happens more often than not. And those people are usually very unhappy.
Wow. Well, look, Rachel, honestly, we could do a whole series of podcasts that, and who knows, maybe someday we will. But I have one last question, which is one I always ask sort of at the end of these conversations, which is for a piece of advice. You've given a ton of advice, so I'm going to make it a little bit more, I'm going to cabin you in a little bit, although I doubt you'll agree to be cabined. So if you wanted to give a different advice, go for it. One of the things I know you think a lot about and we started talking about but didn't get too deep in is feedback. And again, I give feedback, written feedback on writing for a living. I think that's what a lot of law students and junior lawyers come in being used to. And they're also used to getting feedback in the form of grades, which we don't get when you get into practice.
No.
What's your advice for somebody who's starting in the profession, both about how to get better feedback and how to sort of find it and integrate it into their practice?
So first thing is ask for it with a frequency that makes you uncomfortable. Hmm. Second piece is to ask for it with a specificity that makes you uncomfortable. And the third thing is to really sit with it no matter what it is. You do not have to agree with feedback to make use of it. And I think if you have a reaction to feedback, if you go into defense mode, if you start feeling angry, sad, disappointed, I am here to tell you that is a positive thing. That means you care about what you are doing. If I give feedback to somebody and it's constructive and they're like, oh, cool, yeah, thanks. I don't like that. That's not helpful. You probably hate that, right? Mm-hmm. I want to see you process it. I don't want you going to the pit of despair and living there. So then part four is feel your feels and then make use of it.
Love that. Rachel, this has been so incredibly fun. If people want to find out more about you and what you do, where can they find you?
On the internet. We are on the internet, fringepd.com. We're on the LinkedIn as well. I sound like an old. You can find me on the LinkedIn.
Yeah.
And I am just Rachel at fringepd.com with a double A, but if you spell it wrong, it'll still get to me. So I am here. I try to be responsive to my emails, but that's the best way. Find us on the internet and we're happy to chat with anyone who wants to know more about what we do.
I love it. Well, keep up the great work. Keep training. Let's keep our conversation going and look forward to seeing what's next in our profession together. So thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Again, I am Jonah Perlin, and this is the How I Lawyer podcast. Thanks to podcast sponsor Law Pods for their expert editing. If you're a lawyer considering starting your own podcast, definitely check them out at lawpods.com. And thanks to you for listening. If you enjoyed the episode, I hope you'll consider sharing it with friends and colleagues or on social media. And of course, if you haven't already done so, please sign up for the email list at howilawyer.com or subscribe to the show wherever you listen to podcasts. As always, if you have comments, suggestions, or ideas for the show, please reach out to me at howilawyer@gmail.com or @JonahPerlin on Twitter. Thanks again for listening, and have a great week.